Please turn to the back of the bulletins and read together the call to worship with me, if you would. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to plant and a time to uproot,
a time to build, a time to heal,
a time to tear down and a time to build,
a time to
weep, a time to mourn, a time to dance. There is a time for everything, a season for every activity under the heavens.
It will come mine in heart of singing, or in the light it might get some, as all mine heart will speak.
Is a family. That makes every Sunday morning a family gathering, the good kind. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to take a few minutes, just hold on just a minute here, take a few minutes to greet each other. I'm going to ask you to stand, greet people around you. If you find somebody that you don't know, ask them if they want you to introduce them, and later on I'll ask that. So please stand, greet people around you. You have legs, you can move. You know how when you have a family gathering, grandma sits in the corner, and she watches it, and she sits there and feels so warm and happy. That's how I feel when I hear this. When I hear this holy chaos that goes on when you interact with each other, it just warms my heart. So, are there some guests here that would like to be introduced today? Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for standing up. It's wonderful how we're so gracious in inviting somebody else to do something. Whoever said that should have stood up to introduce you. Well, it's wonderful to see that the rest of us feel at home. Absolutely wonderful. We'll look at some of the first announcements a little later on under sharing. There's just one that I want to mention unless somebody wants to stand up and mention another. And that is just to note that today is the deadline for signing up for the Youth Progressive Supper. So if you've been meaning to sign up and you'd like to have the youth over to your place, do it today. Are there any other announcements that need to be highlighted at this moment? Okay, we'll get to one about the choir a little later on, Betty. Children's story.
Good morning. How are you today? We read all together some Bible verses this morning. Did you realize that? When Pastor Gary first stood up, he was reading. Oh, let me find it now. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens. That means there's a time to do everything. Right now, you guys are kids. What is it time for you to do right now? Jalen, learn. It's time to learn. Rhea. Time to grow up. Is it anything else time for you to do? Yep. Piper? Be kind. You know what? I think it's time for everybody always to be kind, but that's good. Today in church, after you leave, the grown-ups are going to be talking about something that maybe it's not your time to think about, but it may be for some of us time to think about death and dying. And I'm going to tell you about this thing that I have in my hand. Can anyone read the word? It's T-U-I-T, and it says, to it. And a few years ago, I went on a fantastic trip with my mom and my sister to Alaska. I was very excited when I was in the store, and I found this, to it. And what shape is it? Is it square? It's round. It's a round to it. Now, I don't know if a lot of you haven't maybe heard this, but the grown-ups will know. When somebody says, you know what, honey, it's time to clean the garage. And the honey says, I'll do it when I get around to it. Do you think Mr. White gets away with saying that anymore now that I have an around to it? So I'm going to give each of you a couple of round to its. And before you go down to your Sunday school class, after we've said our prayer, I want you to go and find a couple of people in church that you don't know and give them the round to-its. So when they're listening to what Mr. Zacharias and Mr. Lowen are telling us today, that they can't go home and say, I'll do it when I get around to it, because they will all have an around to it. All right? Can we bow for prayer? Dear Lord, thank you for the loving family that we have, for the opportunity to learn about what it's time for us to do and to do it in the right time. Help us to make good use of the time you have given us. Amen.
I think maybe we should put one of those in the bulletin next week so we all get one. Thank you. I think you were supposed to bring this one to Carol. While we're waiting for the children, I should just mention that these beautiful flowers here are thanks to the Letkeman family. They were here yesterday for Mary Letkeman's memorial. And just beautiful, as was her life, as was the service. I think it's been attributed to Benjamin Franklin, the saying, there's nothing sure in life but death and taxes. Although I've heard that say death in Texas. But at any rate, we're pretty sure about the taxes. We've got a couple of months to go to tax-free day here in Manitoba. Oh, goody. And in terms of death, if you take a look at our church since Eternity Sunday, there have been 11. We are well acquainted with death in this place. And we know that unless the good Lord comes first, we are all going to die. There you go. It's going to be your flowers up here one day, and one day it will be mine. The Bible is pretty clear about engaging the discussion on death. The Bible says in the Psalms, oh yeah, we're like grass in the field, here today, gone tomorrow, forgotten. We're like mist. It's in there in the morning, then it blows away, like the wind, has all these pictures. Death comes. But as Christians, we see this a little differently. We just went through Easter, and Easter says, ha, death doesn't win anymore. Jesus rose from the grave. We take a look at passages like 1 Corinthians 15, And Paul, after he's had this discussion of death, and he says that we need to trade in our mortal bodies for immortal ones, he says, death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? Done. And so we look at death differently. Do we die physically? Absolutely, 100% guaranteed. But is that how we define ourselves? And the answer is no. As Christians, it becomes very important for us to talk about preparing for death so that we can live fully and so that we can die well. We want to talk about that today. We're going to hear James talk about, from a physician's perspective, what does death look like and how do we plan? And Victor Lowen is going to talk from a lawyer's perspective. What does it look like? What do people need to do? And I will talk, as you see in there, from a preacher's perspective and do what preachers do. So we'd like to invite you, you've got this white sheet in your bulletin, to follow along with that when it's time. There are things that we'll be encouraging you to think about. But today we want to look, as Christians, at preparing for death so that we can embrace life and we can die well. May God lead us this morning.
When Jesus alone was standing by all his friends for God, and Peter nearby denying, saying, I know him not, 'twas then he saw the Savior look at him tenderly. And then remembering the saying, went and wept bitterly. He tenderly looked at me, he tenderly looked at me, at me. He drew me graciously to. When he tenderly looked at me, when drifting away in darkness, lost in the blackest night, out on the sea of sorrow, far from the blessed night, I heard a sweet voice calling, calling from o'er the sea. And then I saw my Savior tenderly look at me. He tenderly looked at me again. He tenderly looked at me again. He drew me graciously to him. When he tenderly looked at me, they took my blessed Savior out to the mountainside and nailed him dead to the cross tree, Jesus the crucified. And when I saw my Savior dying on Calvary, he drew me graciously to his kind look at me.
Before we ask if you have something to share, I'd like to highlight a number of prayer requests in the bulletin. The first has to do with Herbert Knells. He passed away, and there will be a memorial at the graveside at Green Acres at 10 o'clock on Friday, and then at 11 o'clock we'll have a service here, followed by lunch down below. The mission choir will be singing, so we'd like to ask all of those of you who were able to come and sing in the choir to be here by 10:30 and to work at the songs. We'll be actually remembering both Herbert and Annie as we say goodbye to them. Number two, please keep Louise and Rudy Lage in your prayers. Louise is slowly improving. It's been such a long process. And we do want to pray for healing for Louise, to be sure, but keep Rudy in your prayers as well. This is a long go, an awful lot of trips to the hospital, and as you know, we do get tired, so keep Rudy in your prayers as well. And finally, a prayer for Susanna and Jacob Giesbrecht, as Susanna goes in for surgery later this month, so keep them in your prayers. Are there other things that you would like to mention, that you'd like to share about, either prayer requests or issues of praise or things that you just like to get out in the family? James is ready with the microphone. There's piles you have to share, and I am fortunate to hear much of that as we go through the week. So do share what's on your heart with someone else before the day is done, to make sure that someone else celebrates with you or carries the weight that. Would you bow with me? God, we have come together, as we mentioned, as a family. We have come together because we find here people who care about us, people who love us unconditionally, people who struggle together with us to be faithful in following you. God, we also come to encounter you. We come to worship you. For as we stand in your presence, we are aware more fully of what life is really about. We get lost as we go through our world, often through our week. There are things that demand our attention to the point where we forget sometimes about you. So we come here with our struggles and our celebrations and our life. We lift our eyes to you, and you helped us to find perspective. And you give us people to support us, and we are grateful. God, we recognize that we are not always the faithful people you have called us to be. There are times when we know to do right. We know to extend the word of life or caring touch, and we pull back. Because we are lazy, because we are angry, because we just don't want to. We are grateful for your forgiveness, and we ask that you do forgiveness so that we can continue to function as your people, as a family. God, we look at our larger world and we see struggles everywhere. And sometimes as we watch the news, it gets downright overwhelming. And when it comes home and we see hurts and problems and struggles going on in our city and in our country, it's scary. God, we know that you are here, that you continue to be God, and that you have empowered us to respond. So we are very grateful for those who respond to the brokenness and the hurt around us, either professionally or because of their character. We ask that you would give each of us eyes to see and strength to respond to what is there, and also an openness to see you reaching out to care for us. We have come this morning, God, once more to reaffirm our commitment to follow you, asking that you would also today reach out to touch us, to give us life.
Thanks to Ingo and Adrian for making the AV work this morning. I ran in with a memory stick and I thought that would be enough, but they made it work after all, so I really appreciate that. Can everyone hear me okay? Just wait for that. Initially, first a reading from 2 Kings 20, verse 1 to 7. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amos, went to him and said, "This is what the Lord says, put your house in order, because we're going to die, you will not recover." Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, "Remember, Lord, how I have walked with you faithfully, and with wholehearted devotion have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Before Isaiah had left the middle court, the word of the Lord came to him, "Go back and tell Hezekiah, the ruler of my people, that this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I have heard your prayers and seen your tears. I will heal you. On the third day from now, I will go up to the temple of the Lord. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city for my sake and for the sake of my servant David. Then Isaiah said, prepare a poultice of figs. They did so and applied it to the boil, and he recovered. I wanted to start with an announcement. I have a terminal condition that will kill me. I'm dying. Now, before you get too concerned or feel sorry for me, or before my mom has a heart attack, all of you have the same condition. We're human, flesh and blood, and someday we will no longer be sitting in these benches or having fine meals with our families or having an evening out with our friends. It doesn't matter how much exercise you do or health food you eat or how many doctors you see. There's a place for all of that, and we'll touch on that later. But we all have a terminal condition called life, and we're all going to die. Our friends and family will mourn our passing, but the world will go on. And I know we all know that in our heads. But many of us, and many people I talk to, don't really believe that in their hearts. Today we'll talk about death and dying. As a kidney doctor, I'll talk about it from a doctor's point of view. Vic Lowen from a lawyer's point of view, and Gary from a spiritual point of view. It is not the most pleasant of subjects, it's true, but it's an important one. As I look out in the congregation, I know that many of you are grieving the loss of a loved one, and I'm sorry if the topic causes you pain. But as I said, it's important, and it's important to prepare, to think about. It's important to express your wishes to your family and friends. It's important to make them know before you get sick, or someone else will make these decisions for you. As Umberto Eco, a famous author and philosopher, said, it is necessary to meditate early and often on the art of dying to succeed later in doing it properly just once. Next slide. It's working. So what choices are we talking about? In many ways, we're living in the age of miracles. I've listed some things there in the pictures. Modern medicine can do many things. We have dialysis, intensive care, artificial hearts, that's chemotherapy, there's a feeding tube, and there's cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, to restart us if we die. Some people wonder, why can't we just do everything all the time? Some people think, just let the doctors decide. They know everything, don't they? Because we can do so much, it's not about what is or isn't possible. It's about what is the right thing to do or not to do. We can take a 90-year-old with dementia to the intensive care unit with severe pneumonia. But the question is, should we? Figuring out what not to do is sometimes the hardest thing for us as medical professionals to do, and we have these conversations all the time. Once you start asking these kind of questions, it isn't about medical science. It's about ethics and morals and religion. Next slide. Because medicine can't do everything. Eventually, despite technology and the skill of doctors and nurses, we'll all still die. And we know this. As we get older and frailer, we have other diseases. Doctors have a fancy name for it. It's called comorbidities. Medicine will be less effective as we have more diseases. Next slide. Death used to be like this, the red line, the red arrow, where we were totally functional, totally healthy. Higher on the chart is healthy. Totally healthy like Hezekiah, and all of a sudden, something happened. And we got sick, and we died. Some ways, that's kind of how I want to go, but not too soon. If you were born in 1920, for instance, your average age, average survival was to 59. When I read the 2 Kings passage about Hezekiah, I was shocked. I kind of chuckled a little bit. A boil? Really? No one dies of a boil today. As I said, we are in some ways in the age of miracles. Now we cure a whole host of diseases that used to kill us in our prime. And our children today are expected to live 81 plus years if they're born today. Yet, how do those extra years look? Rather than dying, Hezekiah lived 15 more years. I wonder what those years were like. Did he have perfect health? I certainly hope he did. Was he completely healed, or did he have some residual problems? Maybe the sight of the boil was painful. Maybe it continued to weep. They didn't have antibiotics after all. Did he in any way regret the miracle of his healing? I'm not sure. Next slide. Often, though, our last years are more like this. Medicine fixes the easy things, and then we have another problem, and we go down again, and then we get a little bit better, and then we go down again, a little bit like a yo-yo, as we progressively get sicker and sicker and have different conditions. And we know for ourselves, we know people like this. Or we have a very low functional status. Our health is very poor, but we continue to linger on, perhaps in a nursing home. And for many, they beg to die. This is, I think, where good diet and exercise comes in, perhaps keeping us functional slightly longer, not smoking and all the things doctors chirp on about. Perhaps they give us a few more quality years. This brings me to another point. Next slide. Quality of life is more important than quantity. One of my patients, I'll call him Herman, no one any of you knows, was on dialysis for a few years. He was only 69, but he gradually became demented with Alzheimer's. To the point he barely knew his name. He used to cry out and moan on dialysis, as if in pain. It was difficult for the nurses and for me to watch. We approached his son, his next of kin, multiple times, outlining how we thought he was suffering on dialysis and asking him if he thought it would be kinder to stop dialysis and let him go. And just a little aside here, it's okay to stop dialysis, and it's okay to forego complicated medical procedures. Most of the major world religions feel that it's totally acceptable. It's not considered suicide. I've heard that. Some people say, oh, it's suicide. It's really not. It's simply allowing nature to take its course, allowing with the underlying condition to take you home to heaven. Get back to Herman. In this case, the son refused, even as his father became increasingly frail, contractured, his limbs not moving, not even able to say his name. I still can't really understand what the son was thinking. His only response was that he wanted his father to live, really to live at all costs. I really can't imagine anyone wanting to live that way. Imagine for a minute, and I wonder if his father had expressed his wishes, if his father had said, I really don't want to live like that. I wonder what his son would have done. And I wonder if he would have saved himself and his son's suffering, because I think his son was suffering along with his father. Which brings me to my next point. We have to give people permission to die. Next slide. Sorry. I regularly sit with patients and families as we discuss their wishes surrounding dialysis, and this could be any other medical topic, CPR, ICUs. And don't get me wrong, for many, dialysis and other life-saving aggressive care is life-giving. It's a medical procedure that adds and sustains a reasonable quality of life. So I'm not saying never to do it. However, in those already struggling with everyday living, it can simply prolong an already difficult existence. And for instance, for dialysis, it's a daily, 3 times a week procedure that lasts up to 4 to 5 hours. There are different forms of dialysis. There's home dialysis that's done daily. It can leave you feeling tired and worn out most of the time, even when you're not on dialysis. Many times, an elderly, often it's a parent, is pushed into dialysis or into a procedure by well-meaning family members against their better judgment. This often causes family conflict as well, as some family members want to listen to mom or dad, and others don't want to let them go. I find it is often the child who lives the farthest away or has the most challenging relationship with their parents who can't let go. We often jokingly call it the California daughter syndrome. But again, nothing against people from California or against daughters. This family conflict is really hard to watch from the outside, as the best interests of the ailing parent seem to take second place. A family that could support each other and their ailing parent are often resentful and angry and fighting, and the parent ends up dying anyways, but maybe just a few months later. Next slide. I sometimes hear, especially from people of faith, that they are waiting for a miracle. And I do believe, especially after some personal events that have happened to us, that miracles happen. But a recent Time article stated that Christians are more likely to have family members languishing in permanent vegetative states and not agreeing with doctors when they want to discontinue life support. They are waiting for a miracle. The Time article said it best. God doesn't need medicines or machines to make a miracle. And that comment was actually from an atheist. God's will, and we all know this, may not be or to save our loved one, maybe to take them home. and no doctor wants to give up too soon. But after a certain period of time and in certain conditions, we know that further aggressive care just doesn't really make for a better outcome. No, we only delay and extend death. In another article, they commented that family members of patients with cancer who ended up in an ICU rather than in a palliative care ward were 3 times more likely to experience depression and anger in the months following their loved one's death. The outcome for the family member was no different, but the patient suffered more in ICU, and the family suffered more after death. In another sort of aside, we know that palliative care actually in some ways can make patients who have terminal conditions live longer, because the aggressive therapy doesn't always work. Aren't we as Christians also supposed to live life in trust and hope of the resurrection and our eventual place in heaven? Why are we sometimes hanging on so much when the situation is not hopeful? And I think Gary will talk more about that. Next slide. So what can we do to make us more ready to face death? Big talk. Talk to your family members. Talk to your doctor, but most importantly, talk to your family members. And don't ignore the small openings people might start with. My Oma Dick, who died in 2012 at the age of 98 and a half, would often talk about her own death, often replying to party invitations with, "I'll come, if I live that long." It was hard for me to hear that. I'd say, "Oma, sag das nicht," telling her not to talk about that. I kind of regret that now. I kind of feel like I shut her down. What might she have said if I was less afraid of death and more ready to really listen to her? Make your own wishes known. There are living will kits available online that we've provided some links for that can help you make a plan at various stages of health. This even applies to younger people, as signing an organ donor card really helps, can help up to 6 to 10 people's lives to be saved. And once you're dead, you don't need that body anymore. We prepared a form in the bulletin that Gary talked about for a few ideas of the kind of information you want to leave for your family, and some links to some useful websites. I'll leave you with just a thought of how to write up a living will. And for me as a doctor, this may not be entirely a legal living will, but for me as a doctor, it's very helpful to know the intent of the patient. It could be something like, "If I'm healthy as I am now and suddenly get ill, please try everything. However, if there comes a time where it seems hopeless and I can no longer think well enough to communicate with friends and family, then please do not resuscitate me or perform aggressive measures." And again, if you've talked to your family about that, they're the ones making the decision. You make a point of power, a health power of attorney. They can help make those decisions, because you can't cover everything off. Because in the end, we're all dying and we'll all die. We should try to make the journey as smooth as possible. We only get to do it once. Make it as smooth as possible for us and for our families. May God bless us as we continue to discuss this topic.
So if you would open up your hymnals to number 265, which is the Brown Hymnal, and a rather nice rousing song after the topic, "My Jesus, I Love Thee." If you would like to stand, that would be great.
Thank you.
about you, but as I was singing that song, I picked out of there the comments about death that I had overlooked in the past. I'd like to read two verses from Psalm chapter 90. Our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. Teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Victor, please.
Good morning. Well, I have to say, after watching James' presentation, I have to apologize. I am electronically illiterate and not apologetic about it at all. And regrettably, the subject that I have to discuss is not quite as philosophical as his, because it's all geared to the practical level of what happens really effectively after you die. And looking at the age of the audience here, I suspect I'm preaching to the converted. But for those of you who've sort of left it behind, this is going to be your little impetus to look after your affairs. I'm going to follow the format that you have in your bulletins there. Why do I need a will? Well, in my opinion, everyone that's over 18 years of age who has anything should have a will and a power of attorney. Making a will is one of the most unselfish things you will ever do. And in most cases, your family will be exceedingly grateful that you have looked after it. Let's look at the other side. If you pass away without leaving a will, you have given up your right to decide who looks after your affairs. And basically, the Succession Act of Manitoba, Intestate Succession Act of Manitoba, provides who your beneficiaries will be. Now, in many cases, you may say, that's fine by me, those people can inherit, and other people would object greatly to who the Succession Act prescribes as a beneficiary. I'll give you a simple example of one of my experiences years ago when there is no will. I was approached by a family or a couple of family members to look after the estate of their brother. He died at the age of 47 of cancer. He was running a small business. He had had a common law relationship years ago that had terminated. That woman had had two children, but he had none. And his estate would probably have been worth somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 if everything could have been done in an orderly fashion with a will that would have designated who's in charge and where everything goes. As a result of the family bickering, and because there was no will, the application to the court was hindered because the estate being worth over $50,000, you needed two guarantors to sign on behalf of the applicant for double the value of the estate before the court would even look at an application to give someone authority to look after the estate. This took an unbelievable amount of time. I have to say, in the early days when I started practicing law, there was no problem. The lawyers that handled it usually signed and found somebody else to do the same, and the issue was looked after. Since then, the Law Society has prohibited lawyers from doing this. And with the delays caused by this, and also the time lapse, the penalties and interest on this man's loans and mortgages, and the penalties and interest on his taxes as a result of the sale of certain of his assets, basically dwindled his estate down to nothing after a 5-year struggle with bickering family members and what have you. So that's the bottom line when you don't have a will in place to look after your affairs. Now, making a will, this is not rocket science, it's just a question of doing it. There are basically two types of wills. One is a holograph will, which the statute provides. You have to do it entirely in your own handwriting. And you have to date it and sign it at the bottom. Now, if it's more than one page, you should date and sign each page and number it appropriately. And if you're confident enough to do it, I have probated holograph wills without any problems, but I have to tell you, I've had more problems than not with holograph wills. I won't go into the details. The formal will where you have two witnesses signing is basically the issue that I'm addressing here. The purpose of making a will is to express your wishes as clearly and as simply as possible, and under our legal system, as simply as possible for your executor that you've named to access your assets and to transfer or sell or dispose of them in a timely and orderly fashion. Choosing your executors, there are no rules for doing this. The primary consideration should basically be a trust issue. Husbands and wives usually appoint each other, and if both have passed away, the children are appointed, and that works very well. But there are occasions and circumstances where people ask outsiders to become the executors of their estates, friends, or for whatever reason. I always recommend that you do not appoint someone like that without discussing it with them first. There's absolutely no point in appointing someone who is not prepared to fulfill that duty, and then you're basically to square one. If nobody else has been appointed as an alternate, you have a problem that could go back to the original situation that I said without leaving a will. The same considerations can be used, but definitely a few more. By parents of infant children, in determining who would be the guardian of their children. There are many issues here that I don't want to bore you with, but certainly it is very important that you consider very carefully who will actually look after your children. People who express that, well, this person has to have business sense or he has to know how to handle money, that's not the primary consideration. Financial advisors, accountants and lawyers can be hired to look after these things. It is the trust factor that I stress all the time. After all, it's not only the money we're talking about the lives of your children because you're not going to be there. In all cases, alternate executors and alternate guardians should be considered simply because we don't know when catastrophe will hit. The distribution of your estate. Have everything spelled out in your will, it's wonderful. But I have to tell you, after 45 years, I am still amazed and confounded about the little issues that cause problems. You can spell out in your will what your wishes are, and you can list them. You can list them in the will, or I have a clause that I use to list the items on a separate basis. But as far as the actual will is concerned, the lawyer does not need to know what you own. And I've found out over the years there are many people who hesitate drawing a will because they think they have to come to the lawyer with this confessional. And I have to say it actually happened in my own family. My wonderful aunt, Tanta Anna, took me aside as a young lawyer and said in German, of course, she wanted to draw a will. And I said, no problem, come see me. You know, why not? Aber Victor, ich will dich nicht sagen, was ich alles habe. I said, that's not a problem. Sorry for those of you that don't understand German. But she said, but I don't want to tell you everything that I own. So it's not a problem. You just tell me what you want and I will put it down on paper for you. The only time a lawyer really needs to know what you have is if you want to leave specific items to specific individuals or specific bank accounts to certain people and things like that. Or as in the case of the man that died without a will, if you have assets that are potentially taxable, they do have to be addressed meaningfully in the will. You're not doing anybody any favors by pretending they don't exist, because the tax man will get his share. Believe me, that's the biggest issue usually in an estate matter. Special bequests of valuable items, sentimental ones, can be listed in the will. But as I said before, I basically advocate that a clause be put into the will that says that if I leave a handwritten list or a type list dated and signed, it shall be distributed, and authorizes the executor to distribute these items without any consideration from any of the other beneficiaries. They cannot challenge it. And the only problem is, a lot of parents say, no, let the children decide among themselves. Well, that's fine in most cases. The children will agree, and we have no problems. But if you have situations where the children don't agree, somebody has to have the final say. And I strongly advise that you let the executor have the final say after all is said and done. I've drawn many wills where the people have expressly indicated that they want the children to consult. But barring an agreement, finished. The executor makes the final decision and nobody has any right to object. I drew a will for a sweet lady that just died a couple of years ago, about 87, 88, and she had 7 children. She told me the same thing. The children can decide, there will be no problem, Mr. Famous last words. Well, the executor, out of total frustration, one of the children called me after the fact, and I think it was about 6 months later, and said, can you help? I said, well, let me take a look at the will. I can't remember every clause and every document that I've drawn. And just I remember the car salesman that I bought my last car from, but I'm sure he doesn't remember me. And, you know, I have the same problem not knowing everything that's in everybody's will. So I took a look at it and reminded me, refreshed my memory from the notes, that this was her intention, that the children were to decide. And I said, well, there is one beautiful way of resolving this issue. You do have the authority to sell everything at whatever price and on whatever terms you wish. That's usually the final clause in the will. He says, how does that help? He says, lay down the law. You give them so much time to decide and make peace. Otherwise, you will sell everything and just divide up the money. He said, thank you, and I never heard from him again. Resolve of the issue. Okay, now I have the thing here, payment to infants, and I'm sure most of you wonder what that's all about. And I've done that specifically because I want to highlight this. Infants are, in law, simply individuals who are under 18 years of age, who cannot legally contract or give valid receipts for funds received. Simple as that. So when an infant is a beneficiary of an estate, technically without any other authority, the executors are required to hold those funds till that child becomes 18 years of age, and then, unless there are other terms given in the will, pay out that money to the child. That, of course, does not work in a catastrophe situation where both parents are usually killed and there are infant children left behind. Financial difficulties usually ensue, and if no provision has been made, applications have to be made to a judge to get the authority to spend this money on behalf of the children, which was originally intended to do. So my opinion is that young couples who have infant children carry the greatest responsibility in making sure that they draw wills providing for the guardianship and financial care of their children. Whatever it is that they decide, but do it. Because the alternative is quite drastic, even to the point where the public trustee may have to step in and administer these funds for the children. And the public trustee does have a position and a function to fulfill in our society. But they are not always. Public trustee is the government institution that has a responsibility to look after children and infirm people. Sorry, Betty tells me I'm not supposed to spend too much time defining things, but the experience that my clients have had with the public trustee have not always been that great. It is a government institution. You become a number in the institution. They do their best, but they are so extremely busy that they can really not address issues on a personal level. Location of assets is a very handy thing for surviving spouse and executor or the family members to have a list that gives them access quite readily to the information where the deceased's assets are. It just makes it easier for everybody. It doesn't have to be up to date. It's just a focal point from which the executor can look for the assets. And sometimes this isn't a problem, but I have to tell you, in one case where I handled an estate for a normal family, no problems, nothing. He was a retired farmer. And the children felt that they had known everything about him. At the time, I think I was about 40 years old, and this man had been retired longer than I was alive. And he had had a farm out the country. Well, we cleaned up his estate, everything. It was about 8 years later, I get a phone call from his daughter, who was the executrix. She says, "Mr. Lowe, we've got a problem." "Okay, didn't do it right." "Oh, yeah. Out of sort of consideration for his past, he had left a substantial account with the local credit union where he had farmed. Nobody knew about it. The credit union didn't bother picking up the phone calling anybody. There was a substantial amount of money sitting there. The family, they were all flabbergasted, very happy that they found additional funds. But understand, they thought they knew all his affairs. There was not a letter that had come to his house, nothing. He had made some kind of arrangement with the credit union. Leave it there. Well, we had to reopen the estate and look after the issues. Okay, you've got a list here of bank accounts, charge cards, RSPs, RIFs. RSPs and RIFs can be transferred tax-free between spouses. After that, you do have to be a little bit careful, because if, as many of the banks and institutions want you to name or designate a beneficiary of these items, they are taxable. And if you designate a beneficiary directly, it makes it simple for the bank and the institution to pay the money out. They don't need probate. They don't need any of these things. Well, that's fine. But it can be a big headache for the executor, because the tax on the RIF or RSP has to be paid out of the estate. So if somebody wants to really be fair to their beneficiaries and all that, if you advance this kind of money, understand the advanced money goes to that beneficiary, but the rest of them also end up contributing to the tax on that money. And that becomes a sore point with quite a few people. Pension plans are usually terminated on death unless there's a guarantee paid out period. Life insurance policies usually bypass the estate. They can be used very successfully in many other ways, but I won't go into that. Like I say, safety deposit box, keys, mortgages and loans and property, things like that. That's all just good information. But in some family circles, when we talk about loans, especially as people get older and they have adult children that they want to help and benefit, sometimes there are loans to your children. And they can become a sore point among the children after the fact. So if you do embark on any of these, you do not need to have a lawyer, but have it properly documented what the terms are and whether or not that loan is forgiven on death, or whether or not the executor is obligated to either collect it or offset it against the share of that child or children against their portion of the estate. I can't stress it enough. There have been many families that have almost broken up over these issues, and it's not necessary. So James has talked about powers of attorneys and health care directives and things like that. Well, again, if you do not have a health care directive or a power of attorney that includes terms for this purpose, regrettably, you can end up in the hands of the public trustee again. And that, again, I say, is not the best situation. So everyone should really have a power of attorney. The basic purpose of a power of attorney, and it's called an enduring power of attorney, which simply means that it survives your mental incapacity. And that's 90% of why you draw a power of attorney. It's basically geared towards looking after your financial affairs if you are unable to do so, or if you choose not to do so. Then you have the healthcare directive, which you can get online from any government website in Manitoba, and it simply spells out who your decision maker will be for your medical problems. The person in that document is called a proxy. Sometimes a healthcare directive and living will are coalesced, and that's fine. They can be one document. I actually personally prefer time to do it all in one document. I put legal information regarding looking after financial affairs in a power of attorney, and the healthcare directive and the living will all into one document, and it makes things quite simple. So I hope I've bored you enough, and all the best.
You're clapping, but we're going to charge you for that. Just need 5 minutes. There's a passage to the back of the bulletin. Read it. So, thank you so much to the two of you for giving us this information. Please look through those sheets. I'm going to give you the quick version of the rest of it. You hear me every Sunday. The reason that we need to plan to die is so that, first of all, we can truly live. Seize the day. You probably all know people who have been near death, either through medical or for accidents or whatever, and they come out of that and they talk about how the sky is bluer and coffee tastes better and all this kind of stuff. And there's something to that. When you know that today is all you've got, you've got to make it count. And that's one of the things as Christians, when we face death, we say, God has given me today. And so we wake up and we do not have time to hold grudges. We don't have time to hang out with negative people. We don't have time to get our priorities mixed up and think about money instead of people. We need to focus properly because today's all we've got. Seize the day. When I do premarital counseling, this church, I do a little more funeral stuff than marriage, but nonetheless. I do premarital counseling. I say to the people, here's your job for the rest of your life. When you wake up in the morning, before you turn over to look at the person on the other pillow, ask a question. What do I do to win this person's heart again today? They'd never seen me before they wake up. Probably scare them very badly, but what do I need to do to win their heart again? And at the end of the day, they are so glad they're there. It's the same with our Christian life. We wake up in the morning and say, God has given me this day. What do I need to do to maximize it, to enjoy the weather and the music and art and all of these things in there? There's so much going on. We need to embrace the day. Secondly, we need to embrace life by being very intentional. Do you remember the movie Click? Adam Sandler came out in 2006. Fascinating movie. In there, Adam Sandler, this is a spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the movie, you know, put your fingers in. Hum, la, la, la. Adam Sandler is given this remote, and the remote is for his life. And so he can fast forward the boring parts. Well, you know what happens, of course. He misses all the good stuff in life. And he comes to the end of his life, and the angel of death comes to him, and he says, I've been cheated of my life. And the angel said, you got what you chose. And he says, yes, but that wasn't what I wanted. And it's so easy for us to go through life and look back and say, we got what we chose, but we didn't get what we wanted. We need to be intentional about our lives. Each of us is given somewhere in the neighborhood of 45 million minutes. I burned through 31 million of those. And the choice that I have is every day I get up and I have the minutes of that day. I need to be intentional about where I'm going. We all have gifts and abilities and so forth. There's that wonderful passage in Matthew 25 of the guy who goes in holidays, called three people in, said, here's some bags of gold, deal with it, and when I come back, make sure you've done it right. So he comes back, the first two bring in extra bags of gold. Oh, we really maximized. The third guy brought it in, he said, you know, I didn't know what to do with it, so I hid it in the ground. And the point of that passage, in contradiction to the way I grew up, was not to create guilt about the way we've lived, but to invite us to embrace the future. God's perfect plan for us always starts right now. The past is the past. We begin now. And the question is, how will we be intentional about our life starting, oh my goodness, at 12 minutes after 12? Timothy says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. There's some intentionality about that. When my father died about 3.5 years ago, on his bulletin, we wrote, a life well lived. I hope my children. So we plan for our death to embrace life to get all that God has intended for us to get out of it. And secondly, we embrace death to plan death well. We've heard a bunch about that. In the Middle Ages, there was a book written actually in about 1415 to be exact. It was called The Art of Dying. And what it had 100 printings. It was right the beginning of the printing press. And it was translated into all the languages in Europe and England. And it was about how Christians die well. They talked about planning. What are the things you would like to pass on? What are the things you'd like to say? What are the lessons you would like to pass? Amazing. Middle Age, Dark Ages. In some ways more enlightened than we are. On the practical side, if you take a look at that little paper, take a look at number 1 and 2. Pretty simple information. I have sat with families hundreds of times at funeral homes, and often they don't know things. Their mother's maiden name, where their parents were born, where are they supposed to find the SIN number? You know what? Fill it in. Do your family a favor and leave it for them. It's a gift. They go to the funeral home. Done! That's amazing. Second thing I want to mention is the funeral. What are your wishes for the funeral? When somebody passes away, the family often comes to me and we say, well, what Bible passage should we use? And they say, I don't know. Is there a nice passage that talks about death and hope? Let's do that. So we do Psalm 23, Psalm 121, John 14, 1 Thessalonians 4, Revelation 21, 22. Wonderful passages, all of them. I am waiting for somebody to come and say, my dad said his favorite passage was John 3:16. Can you preach on that? We go, you betcha. Leave your kids. What is your favorite passage? Write it down. Why? Leave it for your kids. They're going to love you for that. Or songs. Yesterday, Peter, if I may mention this, yesterday at Mary's funeral, there was a lot of music. And in between, Peter came up and explained why these songs were important. There were songs that his mother had hummed as she was doing laundry and looking after the kids. And it just made the service warm and meaningful. It was lovely. Thank you for that, Peter. What are the favorite songs? I mean, we want to kind of bring them into the realm of Christian songs, hopefully. But what are the songs that you would like sung at your funeral? Write them down. How about other things that are there? Sometimes even fun things. My kids all know what they're going to feed you at the reception at my funeral. White bread and jam. I know it's terrible. It's going to kill you. And it just means I go to heaven sooner. But as much as I'm not supposed to eat that, I just love that stuff. You know the Sound of Music, the song when they sing Adoadir? And then they come to tea, a drink with bread and jam. Bread and jam, bread and jam, bread and jam. They're going to play that. It's silly and it's fun. And at my funeral, when they haul out the white bread and jam and they play this music, you got this down, right? And they play this music, they can laugh. Because that was their dad, as offbeat as he was. Because of the resurrection, we look at death square in the face. The fear and the hopelessness is gone. And we say with confidence, God is there looking after things. This is one of the faces of faithfulness for us as a church. To stand with Paul, having taken care of things medical, legal, and spiritual. And said, where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? And realize that even planning our death is an opportunity to be a faithful follower of Jesus, a witness to the new life we have found. May you find joy in responding to this little white sheet as you fill it out, preparing for your funeral, knowing that this is another way to faithfully respond to Jesus. I'd like to invite you to stand for the benediction, and then the group will sing a song. And now, as mortal people who will all pass away, may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. We didn't have an offering. And so while the group sings, we're going to invite the ushers to come up. And this is part of our plan. So you can sit down and we'll have an offering. Thank you, ushers.
My Jesus knows when I am lonely. He knows each pain, he sees each tear. He understands each lonely heart. He understands and always cares. My Jesus knows just what I need. Yes, he knows just what I need. He satisfies and every need supplies. Yes, he knows just what I need. My Jesus knows when I am hurting. He knows how much my heart can bear. He lifts me up when I am sinking, and brings me joy beyond compare. And Jesus knows just what I need. Yes, he knows just what I need. He satisfies and every need supplies. Yes, he knows just what I need. Love and friends seek to forget me. When skies are dark, when hope seems gone, I feel my face